Well, hello and welcome to the Archaeology News Weekly. I'm David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and so to view details in each source, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. Now, the main headlines from around the world are as follows. A Neolithic settlement is unearthed in Iran, and we discuss the amazing Stone Age of Japan. An amazing prehistoric Bronze Age hoard is found off a Greek beach, and a dig for a sewer turns up 10,000-year-old flint flakes in Texas. A new report suggests Neanderthals had a more varied diet, and, controversially, could submerged Neolithic villages have inspired the Flood of Noah? Which came first, monumental building projects or farming? The debate continues in Turkey. Archaeologists find a piece of string dating back 8,000 years in the UK, while in Spain, late Neanderthals and modern human contact is examined. The future of a British hill fort is put under the spotlight, and finally, back in Iran, the grave of a Kurgan warrior is unearthed. An archaeological team working on the Kelar Tepe believes that they have found a Neolithic settlement on the prehistoric mound located in the Kalaradasht region in Iran. However, they said that more tests are needed to determine an accurate date for the site. Three human shelters were identified during earlier excavations, named Rashak 1, 2 and 3, with the last one being the most important and the largest. The Rashak 3 excavation had become a sheepfold by the people living in the region, and, fortunately, the sheep excrement contributed to the preservation of ancient strata. Samples of pottery have been sent to Oxford University for carbon-14 dating. Covering an area of 6,000 hectares, the Kelar Tepe is a mound 10 metres in height, located in the Elburz Mountains north of Tehran. The earliest known Jomon man, writes J. Edward Kidder Jr. in the Cambridge History of Japan, was uncovered in 1949. He stood tall at about 163 centimetres, and x-rays of his bones showed growth interruptions, interpreted as near-fatal spells of extreme malnutrition during childhood. The joints testify to early ageing as well. Virtually unused wisdom teeth are partial evidence of a life expectancy of about 30 years. And he's believed to have lived somewhere between 7,500 and 5,000 BCE, when Japan's entire population was only around 22,000. Jomon culture was not new even then. Its defining innovation, pottery, was already thousands of years old. It goes back to around 10,500 BCE, indeed. Most authorities agree it is actually the oldest pottery in the world. A sister art was the crafting of clay dogu, or figurines, of some of which 20,000 have been reconstructed, shard by shard. A great many of them depict pregnant women. Rising seas were the prologue to Jomon's emergence at about 20,000 years ago. Stirred by a period of cyclical global warming, oceans submerged parts of Northeast Asia and made islands of the continent's rim. Nomad hunters pursuing big game found themselves trapped on islands in the making, where the giant beasts then died out as the climate warmed and foraging territory shrank. Succeeding millenniums saw these new islanders relying less and less on hunting and more on fishing, and in particular gathering. Gathering itself stimulates and is stimulated by pottery. Pottery is a revolutionary technology which permits storage and the boiling of otherwise inedible plants. It fosters settlements. Jomon people, writes archaeologist Richard Pearson in the International Jomon Culture Conference newsletter, achieved residential stability at a very early date in comparison with other parts of the world. Villages of up to 50 people, containing pit house dwellings and storage pits, date to as early as 9000 BCE. Generally classed as Neolithic, Jomon people somehow resisted the typical Neolithic evolution from gathering to cultivating. Resistance endured longest in the northernmost island of Hokkaido, where the Ainu, linked by ethnologists to Jomon, maintained a hunting-gathering culture well into the 19th century. The name Jomon means cord-mart and describes a decorative flourish that adorned their earliest pottery. Jomon pottery presents a dazzling variety of shapes, surface treatments and artistic motifs. how the leap came to be made from pots, jars, lamps and burial urns to human figures, though, is anyone's guess. Containers are common to Neolithic cultures. Ceramic sculptures, however, are not. And Jomon's is likely to be the oldest of its kind in the world. The earliest pieces are some 12,000 years old, comparable in antiquity to the Cro-Magnon cave art of France and Spain. The Jomon sculpted women, most of them visibly pregnant. Japan's oldest known Dogu figurine, 5.8 centimetres tall, consists of a lump of clay representing a head, mounted necklace on a lump of clay representing a torso, with only the swelling breast to put the object in perspective and suggest a significance. Thousands of years pass, with much production but little progress, and then, more or less suddenly, there's a change. By 3500 BCE, we discern a heightened awareness of the face and its peculiar nuances. Centuries pass, and the faces grow more lifelike, but less human. One looks strikingly like a cat, and another is oddly reminiscent of a Buddhist bodhisattva. She is crouching, one of a number in that posture, the posture of childbirth, so say scholars. The potters and artists of Jomon were probably women. Men's work was hunting and fishing. Did the Dogu, even the more realistic ones, depict living women indeed? Do their tattoo-like markings, their hairstyles, their facial expressions and bodily proportions help us visualize the Stone Age inhabitants of Japan as they really were, or were they idealized beings and spirits? Either way, they were evidently objects of great reverence. An agricultural society can labour for fertility, but gatherers have no recourse but to pray for it. The female figurines of Jomon may be the seen as tangible prayers. There's lots more about that on the Stone Pages website, and so if you pop there and go to the news page, you'll be able to read a lot more about this article. A hoard of 4,500-year-old copper weapons recovered off a beach in the north of the country is the largest of its kind ever found in Greece. A culture ministry statement says the discovery includes at least 110 axe and hammerheads, but several more could be extracted from compacted masses of corroded metal. The hoard would have represented a fortune at the time. The statement continues to report that there was no traces of a shipwreck. The site was probably a coastal area flooded by rising sea levels. The tools were discovered near the village of Messi, 800 kilometres northeast of Athens. Archaeologists recovered it at a depth of 3.5 metres. Many years ago, the area now known as Zilker Park in Austin, Texas, in the USA, was a settlement for some of North America's earliest hunter-gatherers. As many as 10,000 years ago, these people used stone tools to cut meat, chop wood and scrape hides, as well as to fashion spear points. Artifacts of their lives have long been entombed under layers of mud and sediment, washed ashore by the flooding Colorado River. The Austin City Council will have to decide to pay for a 3-month dig in Zilker Park to uncover troves of these stone tools. The dig was prompted by a major sewer line upgrade that was completed late last year that touched on an area of known archaeological deposits. The dig, which is expected to begin in February, would expand on preliminary archaeological investigations in 2006 that uncovered 887 flint flakes associated with the making of stone tools around 10,000 years ago. The investigation was prompted by a collision of federal and state rules. The city was forced to improve its sewer tunnel and lift station in Zilker Park, but the sewer pipe project ran through a proven archaeological site. So under state antiquity code, Austin had to do archaeological work to document cultural resources in the area. In the end, the city of Austin negotiated with the Texas Historical Commission to dig in the field south of Barton Springs Road near the sewage pipe project. The location of that site is absolutely ideal setting for hunter-gathering people to live, right at the juncture of the Gulf Coastal Plain with the Edwards Plateau. It's a great edge of contrasting environments with different plants, animals and soils. For hunter-gatherers relying on natural resources, situating yourself on such an edge is an ideal point to be. The natural makeup of the area, with flooding rivers that wash sediments and mud ashore, which preserves artifacts, makes it also well-suited for archaeological work. Archaeology professor Noreen Touros sought to rehabilitate the image of the Neanderthals as meat-eating brutes last week, presenting evidence that, though they almost certainly did eat red meat, Neanderthal diets also consisted of other foods, including escargot. Evidence from Neanderthal bones collected from the Shanidar cave in northern Iraq decades ago and analysed recently by Touros indicate that at least that particular Neanderthal was not a heavy carnivore. Neanderthals, she suggests, had a varied diet that included meat, but that was not solely or even largely made up of it. One possible alternative food was found in abundance in the cave, land snails. Touros' attempt to show the Neanderthals' dietary diversity comes on the heels of studies that examine the concentration of a type of nitrogen atom that increases in animals as they feed up the food chain. One study showed that Neanderthals living in Vindija cave in Croatia had higher concentrations of this atom than even the top predator, leading researchers to conclude that Neanderthals were heavy meat eaters. Touros questioned that conclusion, however, saying that scientists don't know why that particular nitrogen isotope concentrates in predators, making it possible that other mechanisms are at work. In addition, she said, studies of Neanderthals on Gibraltar showed that they had a varied diet, as do modern humans, who are among the most omnivorous animals on the Earth. Touros was just one expert in disciplines ranging from anthropology to history to genetics, attending a symposium aimed to bridge the divide between traditional fields in order to shed more light on the human past. The symposium agenda included presentations on the Neanderthal Genome Project, the impact of sex-based evolutionary forces on the human genome, and mathematical modelling of contact between linguistic groups, and even the origins of dairy farming. Well, again, I'll say there's actually a lot more to read about this story on the Stone Pages website. So, again, go along to news.stonepages.com and read more about this fascinating subject. A deluge which swept the land of Israel more than 7,000 years ago, submerging six Neolithic villages opposite the Carmel Mountains, may be the origin of the biblical flood of Noah, so says a British marine archaeologist. The new theory about the source of the Great Flood, detailed in the Book of Genesis, comes amid continuing controversy among scholars over whether the inundation of the Black Sea more than seven millennia ago was the biblical flood. In the theory posited by British marine archaeologist Dr. Sean Kingsley and published in the Bulletin of the Anglo-Israeli Archaeological Society, the drowning of the Carmel Mountain villages, which include houses, temples, graves, wells, workshops, and other structures, is by far the most compelling archaeological evidence exposed to date for Noah's flood. He asks what theory is more convincing scientifically, a flood in the Black Sea, far away from Israel, and the fantasy of an ark marooned on the slopes of Mount Ararat, or the reality of six submerged Neolithic villages, smack bang in the middle of the Bible lands. Kingsley added that the site, which has been excavated by Israeli archaeologist Dr. Ehud Galili over the last quarter of a century, offers a pretty convincing cocktail of coincidences. However, Galili rejects Kingsley's theory out of hand, saying that it could never be true. Based upon the archaeological finds, the village was not abandoned due to a catastrophic event, but due to the slow rise of sea levels, which occurred all over the world. The pace of the increase in sea levels was so slow that it would not be significant enough for people to remember it in the course of their lifetime. The alternate theory that the inundation of the Black Sea around 5600 BCE was the source of the biblical flood is called into question by the fact that no villages, houses, cemeteries or graves have yet been found under the wave. Scholars agree the Black Sea flooded when rising world sea levels caused the Mediterranean to burst over land, turning the freshwater lake into a saltwater sea. The flood was so monstrous that it raised water levels by 155 metres and submerged up to 150,000 square kilometres of land. But scholars are divided on when the flood occurred and just how rapidly. Most believe it took place around 9,000 years ago and it was gradual. The date of the massive flooding on the Carmel coast, which Kingsley estimates to have taken place between the 6th and 5th millennia BCE, is also another unknown. Whether or not one can make a direct link between the biblical story and the submerged Neolithic sites is doubtful, said Professor Shimon Gibson, an archaeologist with the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. But it does show that episodes of substantial flooding did occur in these parts of the world. The bottom line is that overall evidence of a world submerged by a flood never existed. Tell you what, I do like a nice controversial story. Why let facts get in the way, as they say? Göbekli Tepe is a hill-top Neolithic site in southeastern Turkey, whose circles of huge decorated T-shaped stones are at least 5,000 years older than any other monumental structure ever found. The German archaeologists, who have been excavating the site since 1994, sum up 4 months of digging that in 14 years they've uncovered barely 5% of what is there. There are still decades of work ahead. Apart from a new transverse cut to the left of the main dig and the excavation of a small late circle that probably dates to about 8,500 BCE, little appears to have changed since March. But there have been striking discoveries. A U-shaped stone sculpted with leopards and a boar that Schmidt compares to the Lion Gate at Mycenae. Two almost life-size sculptures of a boar and a wildcat found embedded within the rubble walls surrounding one early enclosure. And Schmidt and his team have also uncovered a hollowed-out stone, roughly 4 foot square, lying cracked in the middle of one of their circles. Potentially much more significant, although almost invisible to the untrained eye, archaeologists have also uncovered evidence that the builders of at least one of the oldest circles had dug roughly 5 meters down through the mound before erecting the standing stones on the bedrock. For the time being, this is just a hypothesis, but this leaves us wondering whether the site dates back to before 9,500 BCE, when the earliest circles were built, as piling up a 5 meter mound around them is not the work of one night. Whatever the carbon dating evidence shows, Göbekli Tepe stands at the cusp of what is arguably the biggest social revolution in human history, the transformation of semi-nomadic hunters into settled farmers. Archaeologists now know a great deal about the whens and wheres of the birth of agriculture. DNA tests on wild wheat growing on Karakadag, a mountain just east of Göbekli Tepe, suggest it may have been the source of early cultivated strains. At Nevali Kori, a Neolithic village 40 miles northwest of Schmidt's site, archaeologists found seeds of domesticated einkorn wheat dating from 9,000 BCE. But debate still rages about what it was that led Neolithic groups to transfer almost all their energies into farming. For many experts, climate change was behind this transformation. But the location, age and sheer size of Göbekli Tepe have led some to posit a radically different explanation for the change. The intense cultivation of wild wheat may have first occurred to supply sufficient food to the hunter-gatherers who quarried the 7-ton blocks of limestone with flint flakes. Stephen Mithen, professor of archaeology at the University of Reading in the UK, suggests that the move to farming may have been driven as much by ideology as the need to cope with environmental stress. Experts now think farmers probably sowed grain for at least 1,000 years before domesticated strains appeared. In 2004, French archaeologists showed how Neolithic settlers had corralled wild cattle in southern Turkey before transporting them to Cyprus. Professor Bar Yosef has had his doubts about the theory of ideological farmers since the start. His suggestion is that first you need to get the economy working, then you build the monuments that justify the complex social organisation that is required. Well, there we go, another fabulous controversial story, and one that will run for quite a few years, I think. The fibres were discovered in a flooded Stone Age settlement just off the coast of the Isle of Wight in the UK. The 4.5-inch long string was made from tough stems of honeysuckle, nettles and wild clematis that were twisted together. Marine archaeologists discovered it when they found a prehistoric camp 10 metres below the surface and 200 metres offshore. The team led by Gary Momber of the Hampshire and Wight Trust for Maritime Archaeology cut small blocks of the seafloor out for analysis after seeing the wooded remains of the settlement by chance. The string was buried in one of them. The find is remarkable because the fibres made of organic matter would usually decay quite quickly. Now the results have been published in the British Archaeology magazine, and editor Mike Pitts described it as a fantastic find. He said that he doesn't think that the average person realises just what an important piece of technology string has been over the ages. Experts believe the settlement was flooded at the end of the last ice age, when glacial sheets that covered most of Europe, including Britain from the Midlands northwards, melted. So there you have it. Now you know how long a piece of string is. 4.5 inches. It's widely accepted that Upper Paleolithic early modern humans spread westward across Europe about 42,000 years ago, variably displacing and absorbing Neanderthal populations in the process. However, Middle Paleolithic, presumably Neanderthal assemblages, persisted for another 8,000 years in Iberia. It's been unclear whether these late Middle Paleolithic Iberian assemblages were made by Neanderthals, and what the nature of these humans might have been. New research, however, is now shedding some light on what were probably the last Neanderthals. The research is based on study of human fossils found during the past decade at the Cima de la Palomas in Murcia in Spain by Michael Walker, professor at the University de Murcia, and published by him and Eric Trinkhouse, professor of anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis. The human fossils were from the upper levels of the Cima de las Palomas, and they're anatomically clearly Neanderthal, and they're now securely dated to 40,000 years ago. They therefore establish the late persistence of Neanderthals in the southwestern cul-de-sac of Europe. This reinforces the conclusion that Neanderthals were not merely swept away by the advancing modern humans. The behavioural differences between these human groups must have been more subtle than the middle to upper Paleolithic technological contrasts might imply. In addition, the Palomas Neanderthals variably exhibit a series of modern human features, rare or absent in the earlier Neanderthals. Either they were evolving on their own towards the modern human pattern, or more likely they had contact with early modern humans around the Pyrenees. From the Cima de las Palomas, other late Neanderthal sites, and recent discoveries of the earliest modern humans across Europe, a complex picture is emerging of shifting contact between behaviourally similar, if culturally and biologically different, human populations. The future of Shropshire's landmark hill in England, including controversial plans for a huge open-cast coal mine, will come under the spotlight at a public meeting. People will also have the chance to debate whether a new visitor centre should be built at the Wrekin or whether it should be left as it is. The open forum has been called All Friends Round the Wrekin, a group of people who want to protect the hill for future generations. An important issue was the huge archaeological and historic importance of the Iron Age hill fort on the summit of the hill. Group Chairman George Evans said that there's a lot of discuss at the moment and they expect a large turnout. Well, we hope to report more on this next year. Iranian archaeological teams working at the reservoir area of the Khoda Afarin Dam have recently discovered a burial site of a Kurgan warrior during their rescue excavations. A bull statuette, a number of ancient weapons, dishes and bronze artefacts have also been found in the warrior's grave. The Kurgans were an Indo-European culture living in northern Europe, from Russia across to Germany during the 5th, 4th and 3rd millennia BCE. A number of the people also immigrated to northwestern Iran and lived there from about 1500 to 2000 BCE, when the Bronze Age was ending in Iran. So far, a total of 20 graves of Kurgans have been dug from the site, 9 of which were discovered during these recent excavations. Along with the bull, a number of grey pottery dishes bearing geometrical shapes and weapons such as a dagger, sword and a bayonet have been deposited with the warrior in his grave. The archaeologists have previously discovered Kurgan graves containing skeletons of a horse, sheep and other animals during the previous seasons of excavations last year. The warrior's grave, which measures about 6 by 1.5 metres, had been constructed by mud and stone. The stones are larger in the lower part of the grave and become smaller towards the top. 5 teams of experts are currently working at the reservoir area of the Khoda Afarin Dam, which is home to many archaeological sites. The dam has been completed 1 year ago and its filling was postponed following an ARCI appeal for rescue excavation. However, it's not clear how the team can continue working at the site because the dam was officially launched by the Islamic Republic's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, during his tour of East Azerbaijan province last week. Well, we could always say, if you want to look good, you could let people finish off the archaeology. Well, it just goes for me to finish off and say that there's many great websites out there to have a look at. Two, of course, I'm going to plug. One is preservationtoday.com. That's www.preservationtoday.com. And the other is, of course, Past Horizons, where we're working on the January magazine just now. But you can, of course, have a look at all the others at www.pasthorizons.com/magazine. There's also plenty of else to see as well. There's even a TV station. Can I also remind people that many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as a UK heritage calendar, library guidance section, and so much more, can be found on Badger. That's www.bajr.org. And remember, more can always be found at Stonepages, news.stonepages.com. Thanks very much for listening to Archaeology News Weekly. I hope you'll return again to us next week. And here's a thought. Can everybody who's listening to this just now, and there are many thousands of you, I'm glad to say, why not contact two of your friends and get them to listen too? Thanks very much now. Bye.